Hello and welcome to Speaking to Legends podcast, and I'm your host, Nikita Fadeev. This show is a quest for ideas, insights, and stories from the lives of the most successful hedge fund managers, investors, and academics. You will learn about their spectacular careers, their life lessons, and their investment techniques. To dive deeper, visit our website at speakingtolegends.com, where we'll offer show notes to each episode. The legend of today is Fiona Frick. Fiona is the CEO of Unigestion, a Swiss-based boutique asset manager with $20 billion in assets under management. Fiona has been recognized as one of the most influential women in finance on numerous occasions. In this interview, we discuss how Unigestion created a collaborative ecosystem for cutting-edge research, the importance and adoption of ESG, the general trend for passive versus active management, and how to be an early adopter of emerging trends. Let's get right into it. Hello, Fiona. It's really exciting to have you on the show. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Let's start off by learning a bit more about your background. How did you get into finance?
So I was interested in finance since I was a kid, because I thought it was really interesting because it was in the middle of everything. It was in the middle of economy. It was in the middle of psychology. And therefore, I thought that since I was a young adolescent, I would be interested in working in finance because I would never stop learning. And it's the difference between something which is complex rather than something which is complicated. And finance, the beauty is complex because it's interconnected with everything.
And so how did you get from that into like university, and how did that time prepare you for a career in finance, if at all?
I would say it's interesting because I did two kind of studies. So I did economics, and I learned all the classical theory that today you could ask yourself, which there still exists, like net present value, cash flow, and dividend yield, and all these things. And then I also studied the philosophy and the literature. And what happened is that both helped me. Obviously, economics helped me by giving me the academical background and the theory behind everything that was put into function in the financial market when I started in the 90s, while literature and philosophy gave me the perspective of the thing that things can change and that we have the humility to accept that they change and everything is impermanent.
So after kind of completing your MBA, you went on to start your professional career at Unigestion as a fundamental analyst. So what were your first few years like?
So very different from what I do today, obviously, and what even a newcomer would do today, because my job was studying companies which were in the high yield space to make sure that we can invest with them, and that the yield you would get for them was in relationship with the more or less healthy balance sheet or unhealthy balance sheet they have. So my first task, in fact, and you see how it has evolved, was to call the company I was studying to ask for them to send me their last 5-year annual report. So I would then had to wait a week to receive 5 annual reports. And then the goal was to compare notes and compare numbers between these 5-year annual reports and get a conclusion. And I was amazed how you can get the life of an industry by reading the annual report, and especially the small prints in the annual report. So this was really a fundamental analysis and nothing to do with quant. When I started developing some quant tools and be interested for that is when I started being also involved in convertible, because the convertible bonds is a beautiful instrument because it includes some features of corporate bonds, some features of equity, some features of option, and some features of bonds. So it's a mixture of different things that you can try to add parameters to judge them, the option value, the corporate bond value, et cetera, et cetera. So this was my first, I would say, my first foot that I put in the quantitative space when we tried as a team to develop the model to price convertible bonds, depending on the credit risk you imagine, the volatility of the underlying stocks, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, and this was during the interesting days for bonds and for convertibles in early 90s, perhaps even dating to late 80s, where Mike and Milken crowd was at the driving seat of innovation there. It was surely quite exciting time. And so after spending 5 years in research and investing in this high yield and pricing these convertibles, you moved to the side of equities and eventually became a head of that department. But in 2011, you've been named a group CEO. What were some of the notable milestones along the way and any notable stories you want to share?
It was an interesting journey, obviously, with the hockey stick at the end, because the beginning was less quick than one could imagine. So we started in 1995. So Unigestion at that time was not managing equity. And as we were discussing before, we were managing mainly bonds. And we thought it would be interesting to develop for the equity space my way of managing equity that will be similar to bond, because at that time there was really a big difference between bond managers that were very focused on defining risk and defining if the return was in relationship with the risk. So really the first thing you would do as a bond manager was defining the risk. And for equity manager, the first thing you would do is try to define expected return. And therefore, if you define expected return, you would have expected cash flow, and therefore you could have expected price of the stock. So we thought, okay, why don't we try to mix the two worlds and start having an equity management technique that was built on risk? And we found out this article by Professor Haugen and Baker, which was published in 1991, which was showing that minimum variance portfolio were having a better performance than market cap indices. And so, oh, that's interesting. So this is a risk-based equity portfolio that has a better performance than an index. So we started studying that and to see how we could transform this anomaly, which was a market anomaly, into an investment management theory. We contacted Professor Haugen, and then he became a good friend. And it was funny because for him, it was not necessarily the point to show that minimum variance portfolio was superior to market cap portfolio. But the point of his article was really to show that market cap indices were not efficient. So when we told him, you know, we want to build a management technique based on your minimum variance portfolio, he said, why? It was not something that he would have necessarily thought about. But we pursued it in the research, and it took us around two to three years to arrive with a portfolio we would feel comfortable. We added immediately some information about fundamental quality of the underlying companies and some liquidity indicator, because we thought that having only volatility and correlation would be not sufficient to judge of a risk of an equity. And we launched our first product in 1997. So the first part of the journey when we went to see client was not necessarily to say that Unigestion was good in managing equity, because at that point, it was more about explaining why you could invest in a portfolio which has less risk and get better return at the end. So it was really defending the article of Haugen and Baker of 1991, and because this was more or less something which was quite new and counterintuitive. So I would say that the first part of your journey was really to explain to clients that a risk-managed portfolio could have a better risk and therefore a better long-term performance on the long-term than the market cap. And I would say that this first part of the journey took quite long, because we started managing in 1997 and we had our first institutional mandate, I would say, in 2001. And then I think we got our first billion in 2004. So you see that it was a long journey before we got some comfort from clients about the fact that you could have an investment management in equity which was based on risk rather than on expected return. And then things went much more quicker. MSCI constructed an index, the style became much more well-known, there were other managers doing it. And therefore, after that moment, the journey was more to explain why we think we were as good or better than others, but not anymore about the minimum variance anomaly. So the pitch book became quite different.
To me, it sounds like this interaction with the academia is an extremely important component of the construction of the new products and leveraging the knowledge of incoming from there and kind of combining with a good understanding of the needs of investors creates a good mixture that has a good fundamental underpinning, but also serves or solves a particular problem. And kind of with this in mind, we had an interesting conversation with Professor Campbell Harvey a few weeks ago, who is a professor at Duke University in the US. So he has written extensively on this matter of incentives, because in academia, for academic, what's important is to find a signal and not necessarily try to falsify the reverse, but trying to just get into this zoo factory sometimes and get the paper approved and secure a tenure. While from your seat, it's obviously a very different game for you. You want to deliver the promised returns to investors. So how do you solve this puzzle?
So we found the academical world a real source of inspiration. So we try to partner with a lot of universities. We partner with Imperial College in London, with the EPFL, which is a engineering school in Switzerland, also Dauphine in France, which is a finance university. And we organize competition, and we take PhDs, and we also organize conferences internally where we have professors to come. And the idea is to screen what's happening in the market in terms of interesting articles. And then what happens is that we will find four or five themes per year we find interesting. And then we will work with some PhD students to transform what is a very interesting idea academically to see if it holds in real life. And then it will be more what we call implemented research. So we go from academical research to implemented research. And the idea there is to test the hypothesis in the real world. Suppose you use this factor or you use this anomaly, how much trading would you have? How much does it cost? And therefore see at the end if it holds in real life. And if not, either try to find some ways to make it hold in real life, or either to accept that it was a very nice academical innovation, but didn't hold when we passed the test of trying to implement it in real life. And it forced to have a lot of humility. It forced also to have a sort of trial and error framework. Generally, the answer will be not yes, no, but something that goes along the line and where we found ways of making the idea progress. It's quite rare that at the end that we will reject an idea. It's just that we will park it for the moment if we don't find good result, but ideas mature with time. And then when we have some interesting result, there's a third category of people that have to come into the equation. The equation is clients. The idea is then to test the idea, the concept with clients to think, to get their feedback. And generally, we also say that they are our best innovators, consultants.
It's quite challenging to create this ecosystem of innovation and bring these ideas from academia and apply them in real life, because the process and motivations are a little bit different. So creating this framework and making it work is quite an achievement. And we'll get back to some of other things around the research and innovation and artificial intelligence. But I wanted to ask you about the COVID-19. So it's been obviously a large exogenous shock for the market, and it caught many of the market participants off guard. Do you think the active management component of the investment management industry lived up to their promise?
I think it's not finished yet. We'll have to see what happens. And I think we are still in the middle of the crisis, so we won't know who will be the winners of the COVID-19. But I would say that active management, because it has this possibility to be creative and forward-looking, has the best component in order not to profit, but at least to get less hurt by this crisis. Because I think with the COVID-19, we had to reinvent all sorts of new indicators to measure potential performance that we would have never imagined before, like the R of the pandemic and then all kind of numbers and triggers that were not there in the things we were looking. And this goes back to the first question you ask at the beginning: why I love finance? Is this thing that it's always interrelated to other topics. And obviously, this pandemic influenced strongly the valuation of financial instruments and continues today because the economy is dependent on the pandemic and the market is also dependent on the economy. So it's interdependent. So, but I say by the fact that active management has this capacity to see that something has changed in the past and you cannot use the old data to judge what's happening and that you need new information, has this capability to adapt constantly, which is perhaps more difficult for passive because it's supposed to be systematic and with a formula which is set in stone, at least for a certain time.
Yeah, it's kind of what we started with is that you said what attracts you in finance is that it's complicated, that there are so many different factors that you need to look at. And I guess when system just gets out of the equilibrium and suddenly it's a very different beast, then you need to be able to innovate and so continue to be relevant. Do you have any maybe further comments on this?
Yeah, for example, we use, for one of our products, which is multi-asset, we use economical data. And what we realized with the COVID crisis is that if you take your regular economical data, like GDP publication, consumer spending, etc., they would be late. Because in fact, they would be coming 1 month or 2 months after, because they are official data. And it showed us that we had to use different kind of data to imagine what was the real economical situation. And the big data was a big help in that sense, because you would get a first sense of the shock on the economy from the COVID by reading the papers, listening to social media, listening to result comments from companies and what they see in their industries, etc. So it showed that you had to innovate in order to get information about the economy, like footage for shops or restaurants reservation or things like earnings estimates, which were quite different from the regular economical data that would have been used to in our management technique. And for example, we developed during that period what we call the newscaster rather than the nowcaster, which permits to define where are we in the macroeconomic cycle now rather than with these kind of alternative data.
Yeah, it's very important to adjust fast and use the time to your advantage. And so UniGestion had a track record of innovation and being an early adopter on some of the most important trends in asset management. Starting to invest in hedge fund in 80s and even seeding some of the future biggest names of the industry, pioneering private equity and creating this risk management framework that you already partly mentioned about. As a CEO of a $20 billion asset manager, what are some of the key criteria for you to judge? What are some of the emerging trades and trends that were going to persist and how to separate signal from noise?
So the beauty is that we are what we define ourselves as a boutique asset management, a specialized asset management. And we are in an industry where you get commoditized early. So by definition, we have to be paranoiac all the time to understand, okay, what is our value added and how long can we have it before a big one comes and do the same thing for less money? So we have to reinvent ourselves constantly. And that's why we've been changing things quite often, staying true to our investment DNA and values, but evolving in what we propose for clients. And I think this is how we survive, because as a company, the idea is that you have to constantly evolve to the needs of your client and to the evolution of the market, obviously, and profit from that to develop your offer. What I found fascinating lately is obviously the development of big data, because it permits you to have different insights of the question we have. So what is the state of the economy? What is the state of a company? What is the sentiment in the market? So you can have new data to explore. And I think what is interesting is this data doesn't help you assess the question, but it helps you answer the question. So the human is always there to answer, ask the question and then use different methodology to have an answer. And I think big data permits to get different answers and different ways of having answers, perhaps more in time. Another thing which obviously is really interesting is machine learning. It replaces some of the first process we have put in place in quantitative management, such as regression and filtering, by having something which is more adaptive. And I think this will continue. But we quite like the idea of man plus machine rather than machine alone. So for us, it's quite important to still understand what the machine does and control what are the variables that goes into the machine. So we will do supervised learning. And I think this will continue through the years, and it will change the boundaries of what should a man does and what should a woman, and what the machine need to do. And this is the next, in the next 5 years, it will be very interesting to follow how this will evolve. Another trend, which I think is obviously not noise, but is there to stay, is ESG. And I think in this period of post-COVID crisis, where there is such an economical drag, I think it will be part of the asset management duty to participate, because we channel money from investors to the market in order to construct a sustainable economy in the future.
There are so many kind of new trends. If we just specify for a moment on artificial intelligence and like machine learning, now it's widely recognized as something that needs to be implemented, just like a blockchain now starts to be more and more adopted, and people are thinking of it as something that should be explored, something that a budget should be allocated towards. But and there are so many of these things that are keep on popping up, like this alternative data, but then how you do it, what do you use it for, like and so many other things around it. But how do you, from your seat, identify what are some of the trends that are worth pursuing and some that are maybe need a bit more time to evolve into something a bit more concrete?
So for us, what is important is that machine learning, big data is not the investment process. It's a mean that we will integrate in our investment process. So it always starts with a question. Typically, we want to filter out companies which have fundamental data which are not so good. Can machine learning help us? Can big data help us? So it's finding ways to answer questions we already have. And it's quite important to understand that for us, machine learning and big data and robo-advisor or blockchain is not the end per se. They are means to arrive to an end. And the end is the investment process of the manager with the investment DNA of the manager. So we take it step by step. So we have different steps in our investment process. And then the idea is to see each time, can we make this part of the investment process more robust, more innovative, more insightful by using some new instruments that has been developed? And it starts from there. So it's not like a big bang project. There are sums of small projects that, and what we do is at the beginning of the year, we do a research agenda where we allocate people and project. And then we have monthly meeting where we see where does these project advance. And that's how we will discern what we will implement and what we will not.
Makes sense. And so over the past few decades, asset management, with the innovation of coming from the academia, but also from the industry, transformed quite drastically compared to what it was before. I would argue that one of the main drivers behind it was the investors' demand and their growth in their sophistication. So as a result of that, there was a drastic fee compression on the active management and lots of substitutes or substitute-like products on the passive side. But on the other end, the implication is that there is much higher barriers to entry, partly from the coming from the regulatory requirements, but also investment in technology, and the profit margins are shrinking for hedge funds and for asset managers. So what's your outlook for the asset management industry, and maybe specifically for hedge funds as well, in the age of robo-advisors and cheap beta products?
I think the progress that has been done in finance in the last 20 years is to make a difference between what is alpha and what is beta and perhaps something which is in the middle, which is a performance which is explained by some factors, but not necessarily easy to implement, but at least that can be explained either momentum, either value, either quality factors, et cetera, et cetera. So the development of these 20 last years with development of factors and small betas was to define a third avenue, which was not pure idiosyncratic risk, which was pure alpha, I would say, no pure beta, because it's not as easy to construct a momentum factor than to invest in an index, but something in the middle, which we believe is still active management, but at least we understand that there is a systematic premium attached to it that is linked to a systematic risk. So it can be the low vol factor anomaly, it can be the momentum, it can be value, it can be, even though value hasn't performed for the last 20 years, but all these factors that we've seen that systematically deliver a premium into to the market. So that has been a big difference and a big evolution that has put pressure on fees for active managers, because there were some systematic strategies that could be launched that were more made more value for money for the end client, typically alternative risk premia, et cetera, et cetera. How I see the world of asset management, I see there is a polarization between the very big one and obviously the trillion plus companies, which will be one-stop shop, global allocator that will propose everything to clients from, I don't know, high yield in Asia to a commodity in Latin America. And this is obviously not the place where managers like us will be. Look, we define ourselves as specialist asset manager, which will be on the other spectrum that does a few things, but try to do them well and differently. The difference between today and 20 years ago is, I would say that to be a specialist asset manager, you will need more assets under management than you would have had in the past. That's just true, that there is more barrier to entry because there is more regulation, there is more demand from our clients to report, there is more spending that needs to be done in terms of research and technology. So I would say that the cost to function and to evolve is becoming higher and higher in a period where it's true to say that revenues to operate are becoming smaller and smaller. We had the chance to be in an industry where profitability is still quite strong, but obviously this is going down and therefore this is increasing the barrier to entry.
And so this polarization kind of going the next step. So do you think it will be kind of few companies within these two sides that will continue to gain their market share, and disruptors will happen, these disruptions of the companies like in tech, it will happen very rarely just because it's really hard to get in there? Or do you think that some of these like robo-advisor solutions might even substitute some of that?
Robo-advisor for me is more a tool than an end solution. And I think big trillion companies manager will have their robo-advisor. Generally, they also have an advisor attached to the robo-advisor. But it is more of a tool for a global trillion plus asset manager. It's a great tool because it permits to democratize some of the tool that institutional asset manager has been using for years, like optimization, risk models, and things like that. But I don't think they will disrupt the asset management per se. They will be part of the asset management offer, especially with the big distributors. Then there will be a fragmented, so that will be for the big ones that obviously will only be a few ones. And obviously these BlackRock and Vanguard of this world are part of that. And then I think there will be a sort of specialized asset management group that will be very fragmented and that it will be very Darwinistic and it will turn. Because either these companies evolve or either at one point they will be commoditized by big ones that will propose what they do in a very systematized, passive way. So I think the fragmented part will have a lot of churn to be able to constantly demonstrate value for money.
And so, kind of coming back to Unigestion, your firm has been an outspoken advocate for ESG and responsible investment. And you even introduced this idea that it's no longer really two-dimensional, where it's like risk-reward, but there is a third axis around impact. Can you elaborate why this third dimension is so important, and what are some of the practical implications of adopting this model or framework of thinking?
So there is a top-down and bottom-up approach. So the top-down is a bit, what is the role of asset managers? And I think we are going through a transformation of the purpose of asset management, a bit like there is a transformation from shareholder value to stakeholder value. I think the purpose of asset management, the fiduciary duty of asset managers, is not going to be anymore only on the investor they serve, but also to society on a large sense. And I don't think there's a contradiction between both, because a bit like I was explaining before, the interdependence of everything in finance, I think in asset management, there's an interdependence also between the needs of the clients, the needs of society, the way markets are functioning, et cetera, et cetera. What we've done is then we've done a lot of research on ESG, and at least for the liquid part, what we have shown is that if we have some impact purpose or some ESG constraint, it's not necessarily that we will get better performance, and that we don't know, it depends of the constraint. But what we can see is that if we integrate ESG constraint, we get a better risk management, and therefore on the long term, we get expected returns which are similar and better risk-adjusted return. So I would say that, you know, the idea of having a fiduciary management role for the asset manager will be a better risk expected return on the long term. So that's the bottom-up approach, saying that if you optimize and you include some ESG consideration, then your end portfolio gets better risk-adjusted return on the long term. The top-down is the idea that the fiduciary management will evolve from serving your investor to serving your investor and society at large. And therefore, you see that there is no contradiction. You can do both without having, obviously, a price to pay to one of them. You can serve society and you can serve your investors without compromising the two results.
What would you say are some of the common misunderstandings around ESG investing for the investors?
So there is all this theory about, does the ESG bring better performance or not? I think there is no common understanding today what does ESG mean. And it will, although we all speak about ESG, if you speak with different clients from different places of the world, they have different approach to how to implement ESG. So it's difficult to say if it brings more return than other. It's also then when you say that it brings more return, is it because it's just an asset allocation per sector which is different, or is it really because you take idiosyncratic risk, which are different? So the misconception, I think, there is not one size fits all. And it has to be tailored. ESG constraint or ESG or impact investment has to be tailored with each of your clients, and then measure one by one to see if this framework of risk return impact still holds.
And so kind of reflecting when the ESG started to become a bigger and bigger thing and started to be adopted by some of the largest players in the market, just kind of thinking about how the investors' perceptions changed during that time, are they fully buying in into this concept, or some large percentage still struggling with this idea?
I would say 90% of our clients today have some ESG consideration in the mandate we manage. We started managing ESG mandates in 2004, and there it was more of an exception, and it came from Scandinavian clients. And at that time, ESG integration was much more about having some exclusion. In fact, excluding some themes like child labor, humanitarian rights, some industries, tobacco, etc. And from years to years, it became less, it became exclusion, but not only. It became also how do you integrate ESG approach in your process, not just how you just kick out a few bunch of stocks or a few bunch of sectors. Then, and this has been, and by the way, when you say that you do ESG, you have to show integration and not only exclusion, I would say. So if you want to respond to the PRI condition of calling yourself responsible investors. So I would say today that 90% of our clients ask us for some ESG consideration. There will be a lot about environmental, climate change, biodiversity. For a lot of clients, we will have to report on a monthly basis what is the carbon footprint of our portfolio and how does it compare to an index? Is it better? Which they would expect. And so it's becoming more and more mainstream and less of an exception.
Certainly, the concept is no new, but over the past few years, there was like quite a strong push towards the adoption, and more and more people are understanding the principles and understanding the impact of implementing some of these ideas in practice. And so, kind of maybe reflecting on your tenure at UniGestion and your career, where you had obviously a great deal of success, you've been recognized as one of the most influential woman in finance on many occasions and received lots of other awards. What are three pieces of advice you would give to your younger self?
Be curious, always learn, even things that doesn't seem to apply directly to what you do. Because I think it's Steve Jobs that gave the example that he learned calligraphy and he understood at the end only when he started designing for Apple, why calligraphy was so important. And I think with finance is a bit the same thing. I studied philosophy and it's very useful for what I do because it permitted me to have perspective. So be curious and learn, not necessarily only on your focus, but really on a transversal way. Hack yourself, meaning that ask yourself always, what can I do differently? What should I see differently, etc. And a sort of humility. It's a mixture between having conviction and being also humble to understand that sometimes your conviction perhaps doesn't hold for the moment.
It's very, very important to kind of understand in the moment when it's time to kind of back off or to continue to persevere and to kind of keep on to your belief. And this is kind of some of these behavioral biases that I think are quite important, just like all around, like not only for professional career, but also for just personal life. Anyways, it's been like really, really interesting and inspirational. Thank you very much for spending the time with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Speaking to Legends. I hope you found it to be useful and thought-provoking. If you enjoyed this show, please write a review on iTunes to support us. Stay tuned.